Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 8. Now, I don't know whether there's much else about the Vampire or the training you had on the Vampire before you move on to the single-seater Hunter F Mark 1.
That's right, that was at Pembrey.
Now, what about the Hunter? What was that like?
Well, just before we talk about the Hunter, could I just say that Pembrey, I've got very fond memories of the beauty of Pembrey, because although the weather factor was bad, it was a very dramatic and lovely place to fly into, if at times a bit difficult because of the weather. But if the weather was fine, you came in and swept round Worms Head, which was the extreme west side of the Gower Peninsula. And whether you were on the Vampires or the Hunters, often you'd be coming in over the sea, and each day was completely different. And letting down and the sea with that coastline of the Gower Peninsula and coming in there, it was really often very beautiful to let down with the sea varying every day. Moving on from the Vampire to the Hunter, there was no Hunter trainer then, of course. That came much later. And again, looking back, we thought how marvellous it was just to be strapped in a Hunter and there'd be someone probably on the ladder to start with, just to make certain that you were starting it up in the correct way. And then you'd be left to get on with it.
Now, people don't know these aircraft anymore. What was the Hunter like? What were its characteristics?
Well, the Hunter was a great step forward because, of course, it was a swept wing aircraft. From memory, it was 37 degrees of sweep. And about
what difference did a swept wing make?
Well, it delayed. Effectively, both the Vampire and the Meteor had problems just above 0.8 mark. And the Meteor, we had what's called compressibility problems. And it really meant that you were getting close towards the speed of sound, and the air was sort of, you were getting extra drag in front of you. And the swept wing, rather like the way to imagine it, is why you have bumps across roads. You have these strips, the sleeping policemen. If you cross them at the normal direction, you've got the maximum amount of curvature if you're going over in a cycle or if you're going over in a car. But if in your cycle you go at an angle across it, you're obviously it's a far flatter angle. And in fact, the swept wing aircraft works remarkably like that, because you've got two components on a swept wing. The component that's going straight back and the component that's at right angles to the wing. And effectively, the swept wing, which the Germans discovered quite early on in the later stages of the war and even earlier, delays the onset of compressibility, and you can fly faster and with better control.
Now, what about the rest of the aircraft? I mean, sorry, good thing it's got swept wing. What about the rest of it?
Well, you had the Mark 1 Hunter. Its main problem, realistically, was it was a lovely aircraft to fly with totally powered ailerons, which I do not remember this vividly, but people down at Chivna always used to talk about watching people go off in their first solo, that they'd be waggling one way or the other after takeoff, getting used to the powered controls. My first vivid impression of the Hunter was obviously you went up, lined up on the runway, and took up your power against the brakes just to check your brakes were fully working all right, and then you released and you got quite a good thump in your back from the acceleration and went tearing off down the runway compared with the Vampire, and leapt into the air pretty quickly. And I can remember really being very impressed at the rate of climb. And perhaps not, because I wasn't doing it quite correctly, not trimming forward enough, because you're accelerating so fast that you're getting an awful lot of lift, and it's tending to make you want to climb. Any rate, the movement of the center of pressure as you're accelerating, and quite quickly you're already, you know, you've got to get your gear up very quickly, and then your climb speed is at 4:30, and it's quite a flat climb, but you're going up at a hell of a rate then compared with what you've been used to before. And then there's a set conversion exercise, one at a time, where you're doing various exercises on it. Because of the powered controls, the Saber had two had an auxiliary backup of its power controls, but the Hunter controls, if you sustained damage or something like that, you had to go back into what was called manual controls to fly the thing manually, and you could get it back on the ground, ideally, if there wasn't too much crosswind components. It was more difficult to fly with crosswind components, but it was a kind of get-you-home basis, so then you used to have to practice that. And in those very early days with the Hunter 1, one problem with it was what was called a false lock, because you could actually go into manual to practice your manual flying. In other words, you get your home business if the aircraft had been either shot at or damaged or the system didn't work. But then as you were reapplying and going back into power, the little claws that went down and clamped into your power control system, you could get what was called a false lock, and they wouldn't actually be locking, but they'd be locking the rod rather than sticking correctly in it. And sadly, there were accidents when people came round finals and they weren't fully in the complete power controls, and some of them were lost that way. So we used to have to be very careful to do that correctly. And then we were repeating what we'd already learned in the Vampire on handling the Hunter in terms of the fighter exercises.
So you went through the battle flights again.
Yes, that's right, the battle formations, and also learning to lead sections and come back, you know, normally as pairs, but also as fours. But we didn't lead fours in those days, and I think quite correctly, you were really just taken up to be just to lead a pair.
Now, what did you think of the Hunter? Did you like it?
Oh yeah, I mean it was really marvellous. I mean, you really felt, you know, as a 20-year-old, you really felt you'd drawn the long straw of life to be able to fly that in those days, because it was something special. There weren't that many people, certainly in their 20s, that were flying that sort of aircraft, because it did turn out to be an extremely good aircraft. The thing with the Hunter 1, really, was it didn't really have the range. So, you know, 35, 40 minutes, you really didn't want to be too far away from where you had to get back down. And I seem to remember that the average sortie was 40 to 45 minutes. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think so. Whereas later with the Hunter 9, right at the end of its development, when you had 230 tanks you could that you could fly and fight with, you were having sorties almost an extra hour on it, and some of that was including low level as well. The other thing was the early problems with the guns at altitude. And you virtually never on the Hunter used all four guns. I can remember firing four guns once, but it was something you didn't normally do.
Now,
because
why not?
It was tremendous. Well, they were just so powerful. And it was really, the Hunter was designed as a bomber destroyer. And the sad thing was, it was so effective when you were using air to ground with the 30 millimeters, that, and you normally just fired them in pairs, and you were able to select them, inboards and outboard guns as pairs, one at a time, or a pair at a time, because that's the way you normally did it. But because it was a 30 millimeter gun, it was a tremendous thing on the airframe. And originally, and you might well remember or have read, that the Hunter had surging problems, particularly at altitude. to start with, and then they had to carry out certain modifications, which
was... What's surging problems?
It was really the amount of... when the guns started firing, it was actually the kind of shock was disturbing the airflow going through the intakes, and particularly if you were at high angles of attack, you could get surge effects on the engine, and you could get a problem that would you lose your power. And it was solved really by what they call fuel dipping, so that once you started opening your guns, when it was modified later, you'd not so much fuel would be going through the engine, and you were able to continue firing. And that was largely a problem at high altitude. And the Hunter 1s and then the Hunter 4s, which were already out on the squadrons, you had this surging problem even without firing your guns when you did a very sudden break, which was a standard maneuver, you know, in learning how to fight with an aircraft. And you could actually, because you're at high angle of attack at high level, you could actually starve your intakes, and you weren't getting enough flow of through your compressor, and you all of a sudden your jet pipe temperature would come up and your thrust would go down. You'd lose thrust and you'd have to dive down away, and some aircraft were more inclined for that to happen than others, and the less experienced would always get the rubbish aircraft on a fighter squadron. It was one of those things, you know. And so you had to learn how to handle that surge, and that was there with the ones and the fours, but you didn't get it with the sixes because they've got letterbox intakes, so you've got more flow coming in. It used to open to get more at higher angles of attack, and that didn't happen quite so much, but that used to be a slight embarrassment. I can't remember surging on the one at all, but I can on the four when I went out to the squadron in Germany.
Anything else about you know, learning to fly these, well, learning to fly the Hawker, really?
Yeah, the Hunter really was the Hunter was the most remarkable aircraft in many ways, because it was very unforgiving. Sorry, it was very forgiving. You could fly it almost at any speed. You obviously, because it was a swept wing, you couldn't be too silly with it, but its wing was, from memory, 7.5%, so it was quite a thickish wing compared with the 6% wing of the Gnat, for instance. And but it just handled extremely well, and you couldn't get in too much trouble with it, apart from the obvious thing with swept wing aircraft of, as I said, over tightening if you were going around finals and you know, you were being blown in with this business with the wind behind you as you turned onto your finals, and you tried to keep tightening up to get back onto the runway, and didn't sensibly go round again, because that did again happen to people where they, and that was a standard thing with a swept wing aircraft.
Now, anything else that was happening or you were doing at RAF Pembrey?
Well, the other thing I remember quite early on was this business that if you were flying at altitude, it didn't happen so much in the one, but you could go up, and even if you were up just for 15-20 minutes at extremely high level, or up at 40 or 45,000, I think the highest I ever went was, I think, 54,000 but that was, you weren't able to do anything. You were literally just at the top, and you were just that was a kind of pull up one night from memory.
So what was it like at high altitude flying? What were the effects of high altitude flying?
Well, you have to fly far more delicately going round the corners, and that was really what you were learning to do initially on the Vampire and then on the Hunter, to do your battle formation.
Because you'd fall out of...
That's right, because obviously your speed was much slower. Your true airspeed was high, but your indicated airspeed, which was really the aerodynamics of the wing, really meant that you were not too far from the stall, although that was at extreme altitudes. You had to be quite careful, and if you're rough, obviously there's a lot more drag and you're going to lose position, which you can't afford to do. And we tended to fly at 0.9 later, but you could also fly at sort of 0.85, and it depended on your tactics, what you did there. But what I was trying to get round to saying was the heat soak, or rather the cold soak at altitude, because if you're up at altitude for more than 15, 20, 25 minutes, very quickly the airframe got so cold, and then you came down very rapidly. You did have in the Hunter a flood flow system, which you always, just as you were about to go down, you switched forward and got a tremendous extra burst of hot air and pressurized air coming in to help you. But if for some reason you forgot that, you only ever did that once, because the whole cockpit would be you'd have very little fuel by the time you got down, and if you came down extremely rapidly like that, you would have mist all over the place, and you wouldn't be able to see out of the cockpit.
Did the effects of high altitude G, did they have any effect on you?
Oh, I forgot to mention, obviously we'd got our G suits by then. You got an anti-G suit.
Tell me about the anti-G suit.
Well, the anti-G suit was round. You had a kind of something like a bladder, as a, like the sort of inside of a rugby ball, in a suit round your stomach, and little bladders similar, which were inflating on your upper leg and your lower leg, and the whole thing was sort of strapped together like a kind of corset all the way down your legs. But it was just a half body suit we wore, and that was connected to a pressure, so that immediately you had G coming on, you had extra pressure would go in and inflate the bag and stop the blood flowing away from your would retain your blood. It was really, as much as anything, to stop it from your head, because it was the blood flowing from your brain that caused the at high G. We're really talking about sort of 6G, which you could easily do, and often you did. But that would help, because it would, the pooling of that would stop the blood draining down into your legs under high G, and it would give you, I think it was 1.5 G effectively it gave you. Obviously it varied depending on people, but really it gave you effectively the capabilities of operating at max rate turns that we talked about earlier. Because very quickly you lost height, and although you couldn't get 6G when you were up at 40 or 45,000, I mean, if you were doing a dive down, you very quickly got up to that level that you'd be using that G in a sort of practice combat situation.
Did very high altitude or the cold or anything like that affect you? You know, I mean,
No, I don't think so. I mean,
did it give you headaches or anything?
No,
you had oxygen, didn't you?
Oh yes, sorry. And the Hunter had high pressure oxygen. It was the first one really where it was very well designed on that front.
So how did it work? That's in your mask, is it?
Yeah, you had a mix of oxygen, and you had a what's called a pressure mask already, where you had a kind of grill on your mask that it clamped down in such a way that it was held very firmly against your on top of your nose and round your mouth, and it had a seal inside it that tended to be pushed out, the wide seal, by the extra pressure and the oxygen coming in, because once in Germany I did have this quite dramatic incident where somebody had pulled his oxygen tube out, but it was something that was drilled into you, because there are quite a few aircraft were lost, as you know, through anoxia, and it was something that you were made very conscious of, the importance of oxygen. And something I didn't mention,
otherwise you'd lose
your... Yeah, because something I didn't mention, I learned very early that I needed oxygen more than most people, because
now, can you explain it What is the need for it? What happens if you don't?
Well,
take oxygen?
Roughly at 10,000 feet, you start needing oxygen, and that was a rough rule of thumb. And I can remember vividly, because I was in a piston provost, and I didn't mention that, a provost doing a cross country, and I went to the second turning point, and my instructor knew straight away what had happened, because although we just climbed up to 10.5, I think, but I'd been at 9.5 for some time, and I think we came back at 11.5, but that was really still remarkably low, but I just kept turning my map round, and I had no idea where I was, and I was obviously already in that state of confusion which occurs when you're not getting enough oxygen, and people vary. And I was very grateful for that experience, because in a way my instructor immediately knew what had happened, and it was surprising that it just in that not having oxygen in that piston provost for that length of time had affected me. And it's something you're always very careful of, and the hunter was very good, because you had a black and white doll's eye that you knew that you were breathing all the time the right amount of oxygen coming in, and that was connected, and you could feel it as well. And then you were getting increasingly 100%, and then you were getting pressurized oxygen, and then you've got an emergency supply if necessary.
But you didn't do any tests on the ground to see how you reacted with oxygen, because
there was a decompression chamber. I probably should have mentioned that I believe it was up at North Luffenham, but whether I went North Luffenham then or later, I have no idea. And of course we did, the other thing I haven't spoken about was we did a helicopter, and being dropped off by the helicopter and being dropped off launches for the survival side of aspect of the of operating our dinghies on our dinghy pack.
And
for
when
the
had
ejections.
You done that?
We did that. I can remember doing that at being dropped off either or both. I think I was dropped by a helicopter the first time. I think
when was this?
At the OCU.
Well, that's where we're up to, anyway. So well, tell us about that. The survival drops.
And really, the answer, like we'd done dinghy drill, almost from the word go at Cranwell, where you had to swim 15 lengths in your denims and 15 lengths one way and 15 lengths on your back or something like that, and then also with your May West on, which is even more difficult, of course. But And getting in and out of your dinghies in exactly the same way as part of the course, you were often taken out in a marine craft and just sort of jumped off the back and then had to operate your May West and your getting into your dinghy, your K-type dinghy, which is a little single seat dinghy with hoods, and it was already quite developed. And later we got the Kevlar thing, which was quite easy to...
What about the drops from helicopter? What were they like? Were they from how high up? Not high, I presume.
No, not at all.
Just dropping you into the sea?
Yeah, that's right. You just jumped out, you know, the few feet, whatever it was, 6-8 feet down into the water from... I think the first one was a sycamore. Inevitably, it must have been. And again, just to practice that same thing that you had your... Your dinghy on, your May West on, and you just inflated your May West, and then as quickly as you could got in your dinghy, because your survival, one of the important things was in the winter, you literally had 2 minutes if it was sub-zero, and obviously the sea, the North Sea, is pretty close to zero in January and February, by the time January and February gets round. And later we were flying in immersion suits if you were
later.
Flying much later, yes, but this really,
I mean, when you did this was winter, so
yes, I mean, a friend of mine, you know, that I remember from Cranwell, one of the sad fatalities up there, was a very fit bloke. He was one of the best gymnasts that Cranwell had had, and sadly by the time he ejected, it's not ejected at all, he bailed out over the sea, and by the time the chopper got out to him, literally, they weren't able to. I think there was some problem, either delay or that, but they just got to him far too late on that bit. And he was a very fit chap.
Anything else you were doing at Pembrey?
No, all I can remember again is marvellous ground crew there, I thought, and very, very well organised and very pleasurable, you know. And I think people really, they were quite prepared to pass on anything and everything that they knew. Because in those days, later in the squadrons, there was a slightly macho element that you'd got to learn the hard way a wee bit on squadrons. It became less and less so quite quickly from then on. But already in 1957, when I joined my first squadron, there were two people who were very good. But all I'm saying is that at the Operation Conversion Unit, people were very good at passing on whatever they could, their knowledge to you. And these were all guys that had done one full tour, almost invariably, some of them two tours on fighters. Many of them had come back, almost all of them had come back from the Middle East. They'd either been in Mafraq or Shaiba, they come back from Iraq.
And these are your instructors?
Yes, yeah.
They were generally good?
Oh, yes, yeah, and I think they're fine, very pleasant people. Quite a few of them short service guys. And I never got myself ever in my career, from my perspective, what I heard some other Cranwellians saying, that really, in a way, they were slightly got at because of that. But I never ever sensed that, and I'm intrigued when I hear of other Cranwellians talking about that.
Now, what about mess life? What was the mess life like at Pembrey? You're a pilot officer now. What was the mess like there? The officers.
Well,
mess?
it was quite lively, and
in what way?
It was. Well, there was a good spirit then, and there was obviously a degree of sensible difference between the people that were on the staff and the people that were on the course. The other thing I didn't mention was that if you didn't go on the hunters, the other people went on the venoms, because
I'll come back to that. Sticking to the mess. Sorry,
the venoms. There weren't venoms there, but they were
sticking to the mess.
Well. I just think I can't remember anything extraordinary about that, really, at all. I can remember a vivid court-martial we had there with the rather splendid Colin Coulthard, who died 2 years ago, who was the chief instructor, wing commander flying there. I think the other big memory, quite apart from the mess, was of the IRA
so,
side.
So it wasn't a properly organised mess or life or anything there.
Yeah, no, I think that side, I can remember chasing off at weekends a bit because I had my motorbike down there. And I can remember the Welsh police.
I mean, was it set up as a normal officers' mess or not?
Yes, yeah, and you were a full member of the officers' mess, even if you were a student. So the students and the you were all just in the officers' mess, and it was sensible for you to meet and chat and talk to the guys who'd done their full fighter tours.
So wasn't a restriction on talking shop like they are. How formal a mess was it?
Well, I'd say it was reasonably formal. The other big memory was the number of extremely interesting cars at the back of the mess in those days.
And what about drinking habits in the mess?
Well, I didn't mention, but I still had slight problems from... I'd had a motorcycle accident, and in fact, my advanced instructor, and that was even on the Balliol, knew, and also on the Vampire, I think I told him. Because I'd had concussion, and I was still in that stage where a year, just over a year beyond concussion, that you have a declining threshold where alcohol affects you, and you tended to get headaches with with alcohol, which was quite interesting. And fortunately, both my flying instructors knew, because I really got myself out of the hospital after I had this accident, on a motorcycle accident, far too quickly, and did have this concussion. So again, we were talking about G, and that was did affect you more with it, having had this concussion, because I think in some ways, you know, I was only just marginally fit to fly from that point of view, even though I got by it all quite okay. But in the back of my mind, I knew, and what was great was when that, just over a year after my motorcycle accident, I had an uncle doctor, and he told me about this, and all of a sudden I was all right, and that happened about 6 months when I was in Germany. But you wanted something about the mess, but the mess was...
No, that's fine. We've moved on from the mess. Yeah. On to the motorcycle.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, you mentioned one other thing, which I cut you off from, saying that not everybody was going on to vampires.
Not everyone was going on to hunters.
Hunters.
And I might have confused hunters, you. There were only vampires down there, and hunters. And there weren't, obviously, that many hunters. But there was another stream going by. You were either in the hunter course, or I think I was five hunter from memory. I think I was number five hunter. I could check that up. But there were also venom courses going through, although there weren't any venoms. But they were doing a course like we'd done on the vampires, but a bit more extended. I think they did a short bit more, but they weren't doing the hunter conversion, so they were going off to venom squadrons, which was still there in the Far East.